A word of warning. What follows includes harrowing testimony and graphic descriptions of human rights violations.
We welcome all those who will be telling their stories, as well as their relatives and friends.
Desmond Tutu.
We will want to hear their stories. That is the basic reason for these hearings. For the Human Rights Violations Committee to help the Commission determine whether particular persons have suffered gross violations of their human rights, and for those persons then to be declared victims, who will thereafter be referred to the Reparation and Rehabilitation Committee of our Commission, which then must make appropriate recommendations to the president of our country for the nature and size of reparation to be given. Thank you, all of you here in South Africa and around the world who have prayed and are praying for the Commission and its work. We are charged to unearth the truth about our dark past, to lay the ghosts of that past so that they will not return to haunt us, and that we will thereby contribute to the healing of a traumatized and wounded people. For all of us in South Africa are wounded people. And in this manner, to promote national unity and reconciliation. We want to indicate that those who testify before this commission will enjoy the same privilege as would happen in a court of law for the testimony that they give, provided what they say is the truth as they understand it, and provided what they have done is done in good faith. I now declare that the hearing of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission is now in session. We will now sing Lizaliswe Idinga Lakho.
Lizaliswe Idinga Lakho. Thixo Nkosi.
Invite Mrs. Nohle Mahapi to take the stand.
Alex Borain.
Mrs. Mahapi, do you wish to take the oath or to make an affirmation?
Yes, I will take it.
Thank you very much. Do you solemnly swear that the evidence you will give before this commission will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
So help you God.
Thank you very much indeed. Do be seated. In welcoming you as the first witness in the proceedings of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, we are mindful of the sufferings that you have endured in the past. Many of us remember, as though it was yesterday, when Mapetla died in police custody. We remember the anguish and the horror of those days. We know that you too have been detained and were in solitary confinement. And we salute you as someone who has witnessed to great courage. And you coming here today is a testimony to your commitment to truth, to justice, to reconciliation, and to peace between you and all South Africa. Tiny Maya, who is sitting on my right, will lead the questions which the Commission would like to ask as you give your testimony. You are very, very welcome.
Thank you, Alex. Before we begin, I would like to indicate that my witness would be more comfortable with presenting her testimony in Xhosa. So I would like everybody who does not understand Xhosa to put on their headphones so that we can begin.
The first week of Truth and Reconciliation Commission hearings in East London was an exceptional one in South Africa. Nothing like the miracle election of April 1994, nothing like the government of national unity, and nothing like South Africa's unifying sport victories. Mid-April 1996 was a week in which the country and its people came face to face with their past for the first time. Darren Taylor and Zola Ntutu reflect on the dominant themes that surfaced in the first 4 days of the Truth Commission's probe into gross human rights abuses during the apartheid era.
During the time when the herald was being delivered, I look at the headlines, and one of my children said, "Mother, look here, the car belonging to my father is burnt."
No Monday Kalata.
At that moment, I was trembling because I was afraid of what might have happened to my husband. Nyami was always supportive, and I was still 20 at the time, and I couldn't handle this. So I was taken to Nyami's place, and when I got there, Nyami was crying terribly.
The wailing cry of Nomonde Tralata ushers in the Truth Commission. She's the widow of Fort Tralata, one of the Cradock Four activists. Wave after wave of stories, best expressed in a mother tongue, are told and shared with pure forcefulness. Stories that unlock the horror, the suffering, the pain, the injustice and the brutality of South Africa's past. Not with frigid facts or courtroom coldness, but with gripping memories.
Next to the bench, there was a small plastic, which is like a tube of the tire. It was taken off from this water, and then it was put on my head.
Joe Jordan.
You can imagine that. How can you breathe if you have a plastic over your head? The water was then thrown over my body, and I was electrocuted. I tried to struggle, but I was unable to do anything about this. The electrocution continued for a long time. I was screaming all the time, and I realized that I was losing consciousness. They asked me if I want to tell the truth. I said, "I do not know Steve Chwete." They continued with the electrocution. Even in my genitals, they did this. Even through my anus, they did this. They electrocuted me through every hole that they could find in my body. And on my head, there is this tube. I was suffocated. I couldn't cry. I couldn't do anything.
Various themes are flung to the forefront, the strongest highlighting that the Eastern Cape province of South Africa has been riddled with disgusting deeds. But why? And why the Eastern Cape? The Eastern Cape has a history of oppression and resistance. It's also the birthplace of some of the country's well-known leaders like Steve Biko, Oliver Tambo, Winnie Madikizela Mandela, and Nelson Mandela. No wonder it was said in security circles, "He who can destroy the Eastern Cape will rule the country."
The response of the state was to bring in its forces to try and intimidate and break the community resistance. Violence escalated and the community decided to embark on a school boycott.
Nyami Goniwe.
The demands of the students were the immediate reinstatement of Matthew Ganiwe. Matthew's unpopularity with the security forces intensified. He was hated and regarded as an enemy of the state. The whole family bore the wrath of the security police, which took the form of harassment, early morning house raids, constant surveillance, death threats, phone bugs.
But there's a deeper reason why atrocities that have haunted people with previously unknown horrors were committed here. It appears that the Eastern Cape was the best dumping ground for those who got out of hand, like former policemen and soldiers, black and white, from the counterinsurgency unit, Kufut, and the Defence Forces' notorious 101 and 32 battalions.
The names of several alleged security force perpetrators crop up time and time again. Gideon Nivot, Albert Tungata, Eric Venter, Chris Labuskagne, Speaker van Wyk, and Gert Strijdom, as well as men known only as Hateng, Fouchier, and Ngai. The connection, torture and murder, bland and mild words.
That's food.
Yeah. I read the documents about the post-mortem. In the upper abdomen were 25 wounds. These were the wounds
different sizes of weapons were used,
explaining the fact that different weapons were used to step him, and then or a group of people stepped him. Now, in the lower part, he also had wounds. But the wounds in total were 43. One other thing that we understood, they poured acid on his face. After that, they chopped off his right hand. I don't know what did they do with that hand.
At Louis Le France, there was a bottle. It contains water. I don't know how does it smell.
Fezile Jacobs.
That is where I was sold this hand of Mrs. Sicelo. And then they said this is one of the baboon hands that is kept in this bottle. And I knew that Sicelo was buried without his hand. Who showed you this hand? Was it the policeman? Yes, it was Mr. Hatang. There's another one, Nivot.
The public perception that stories of gross human rights abuses will only come from one side of the political spectrum is proved wrong. All parties are accused, and all sorts of people come forward. Every black victim is accompanied by his or her family, but not Carl Weber. He was disabled when the PAC's military wing, APLA, attacked East London's Highgate Hotel with AK-47s and grenades in May 1993. His only refuge as he sits all alone is the black woman, who guides, soothes and comforts every single victim.
It took me last month as a year to teach myself how to get dressed, to feed myself. There are things I can't do. I can't get to the right hand side of my face because of the fixtures in my elbow. I need assistance when I need to be shaved. I need assistance when I need to be bathed.
Then there is the audience, which packs the town hall in the heart of East London every day, but virtually no white face. This doesn't escape a black resident, Richard Somlota.
It is a great concern that the white communities didn't turn up, even those who were the victims of the resistance of the apartheid.
Then there are the women. 60% of the victims who testify are women. They weave their household chores into almost all their agonies.
In June, I was arrested. I was taken from my place early in the morning when I was busy preparing breakfast for my children.
Nomali Galela.
There was a big policeman, a huge man, and I could see that there were so many boars next to my door. And he grabbed me by the scruff of the neck, and they broke in to the ceiling and obtained so many grenades, but we were not aware of them. Photos were taken about the house. It was searched all around. We were taken into custody. Mr. Tungata was amongst them. and the whole system was outside because I was labeled as a terrorist. And I just left a message for somebody to look after my children.
What towers over everything for most of us is the web of sorrow, spun around the maimed and the dead. But not for me, says Truth Commission Chairperson Desmond Tutu.
The oppressive system of apartheid did not stand a chance. The people who've come forward here are people of quite extraordinary character.
Very much for your hospitality.
The world is amazed as it hears the harrowing stories that you have been telling, that there can be this willingness to forgive, this humaneness. On the one side, you have a Mrs. Savage saying the traumatic experience she's had has enriched her life, and she wants to meet the person who did this in a spirit of forgiveness.
What I would really, really like is, I would like to meet that man that threw the grenade in an attitude of forgiveness.
Beth Savage.
And hope that he could forgive me too.
And then the people from Credo saying, now something like a heavy burden has been removed from them.
But now that I'm here, I'm just sort of humbled by the experiences of the others.
Nyami Goniwe.
I'm happy to say that I'm happy that I came.
All of your stories are stories that are going to inspire us and inspire our people for many a long day.
I want to read from two letters that I received yesterday. As an ordinary member of the public, I would like you to know that I have been intensely moved and inspired by the testimonies heard at the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in East London last week. My pain and inspiration have come from the awesome, horrific, and humbling stories and the extraordinary forgiveness of those wounded people. We are all wounded. I wrote a poem to try and understand what all this means, and I would like you to know that there are many people out there who feel with those people. The pain belongs to us all. Thank you, all of you, for your own humanity and for helping us all towards healing. And the poem, "The World Is Wept." Blood and pain seep into our listening, into our wounded souls. The sound of your sobbing is my own weeping. Your wet handkerchief, my pillow for a past so exhausted it cannot rest, not yet. Speak, weep, look, listen for us all. O people of the silent, hidden past, let your stories scatter seeds into our lonely, frightened winds. So more, until the stillness of this land can soften, can dare to hope and smile and sing, until the ghosts can dance unshackled, until our lives can know your sorrows and be healed.